Hello and welcome to 2026. I'm Marek Schneider, and welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled, My Parents' Secret for Living Well into Their 90s, Embracing Strangers, by Exilio Emanuel. Then we have an article by Daniel S. I thought a cane would make me feel old. It surprised me. Then Andrea Peterson and Laura Cooper wrote, Business is booming for brands that sell beverages to aid sleep. And we'll follow that up with an article by Bob Green, The 21st Century is Getting Old. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one, My Parents' Secret for Living Well into Their 90s, Embracing Strangers. My father did not meditate, did not track his steps or explicitly exercise, and never once uttered the word mindfulness. Yet he lived to 92, dying at home after a very short bout with brain cancer, having been visited by his children and 11 grandchildren in the 10 days between diagnosis and death. And my mom is still going strong at 92. She still has her sense of humor and her political engagement, but no diseases that will kill her, as she puts it. I have spent my professional life studying what makes people live healthier and longer. I've analyzed data sets on longevity the world over and reviewed hundreds of clinical studies. I have heard numerous new claims about supplements, diets, and tech devices that are supposed to extend life. But nothing I have read in scientific literature explains longevity better than the lives of my incorrigibly social parents, Benjamin and Marcia Emanuel. My father was a pediatrician who spoke 5 languages and was comfortable talking to anyone and everyone. In the melting pot that was Chicago, immigrant parents brought their children to him because he always found a way to communicate with them and care for their children, often for free. He routinely talked to strangers, offering suggestions based on his well-honed diagnostic skills. My father loved to travel and explore new towns, national parks, and monuments. During my childhood, whenever we stopped in a restaurant, he would start chatting with the people at the next table within 5 minutes, asking about their jobs, their families, where they were from, and what they liked about the place they lived. If no one was at a nearby table, he would strike up a conversation with the waitress. To a modern eye, this might seem overzealous. But people responded to him. They felt seen, not interrogated. There was no agenda, just my father's insatiable curiosity about people. I once watched him spend an entire bus ride diagnosing a fellow passenger's goiter and then offering her advice about which kind of doctor she should consult. Another time, a casual chat with another father in a park ended with an invitation for our whole family to dinner at their home. My mom was also incurably social. Our house was constantly filled with the people she collected. She was a civil rights and anti-war activist in the 1960s, and our home was the venue for myriad meetings to plan demonstrations or practice protecting yourself from police batons. My mom also took in many children and relatives when things weren't going well at home. One cousin stayed for 2 years recovering from hepatitis. And my mother was great at making our teenage friends feel understood with warmth and empathy. When her kids went off to college, she finished her training as a therapist and went into practice. For years, I did not fully appreciate what I was witnessing. To me as a kid, my father's endless chatter was an embarrassing quirk of his personality. And my mother's welcoming of strangers into our home just seemed, well, normal. Only after decades as a physician and policymaker did I understand that my father and mother had unintentionally but eagerly adopted one of the most powerful health interventions ever discovered, human connection. Study after study now confirmed what my father and mother intuited long before science caught up. Social relationships, both the deep ones and the fleeting exchanges, reduce stress hormones, lower blood pressure, reduce inflammation, strengthen immune function, and make you happier. They may even slow cellular aging. An analysis by the Health and Retirement Study, which enrolled over 20,000 Americans older than 50, found that over the next 8 years, people with the most close friends, an average of 7.8, had a 17% lower risk of depression and a 24% lower risk of dying compared with people who had fewer close friends, an average of 1.6. Similarly, Harvard University's study of adult development, which followed people for over 80 years, found that the people who were happiest, stayed healthiest as they grew old, and who lived the longest were the people who had the warmest connections with other people. By contrast, social isolation is as dangerous to longevity and cognitive decline as being obese. My father did not need PubMed to know that being interested in people kept him not just alive, but vibrant and energetic. My parents were also, in the truest sense, healers. Not just in the hospital or therapist's office, but on the street, in the park, on the bus. My father and mother saw suffering as a cue, not to retreat, but to engage. Once we were in the park and my father saw a boy's unusual gait, he gently suggested to the boy's mother that he might need a brace. She thanked him. I cringed with embarrassment. Years later, I came to see that impulse, to notice, to care, to connect, and help was the very definition of wellness. My father's memorial service overflowed with friends, former patients, and neighbors, each one with a story about how we'd helped them, laughed with them, or simply made them feel less alone. Every Thursday, meanwhile, my mom still has lunch at the deli with the boys, friends she has collected over the years. It's taken me many years to grasp that wellness is inherent in the community we inhabit. My father's conversations with strangers weren't just good for him, but for the people he engaged with. My mother's weekly lunch is both good for her and for all her friends. Sharing time with others is beneficial for all involved. If there is a longevity hack, that is it. Forget the cold plunges, red lights, and fad-driven supplements. Call a friend. Chat with your neighbor. Ask the Uber driver or grocery checkout clerk how their day is going or how their holidays were. When I think of my father and mother now, I realize that health isn't something you achieve in isolation. It is something we all create together. And now, I thought a cane would make me feel old. It surprised me. One morning recently, I threw out my back. It would not have been my first choice for something to discard. I'd have nominated the haggard horse face that stares back at me daily when I shave, but nobody asked me. I just bent over and, on rising, was halted by the grip of agony on my lower spine. I couldn't even walk without leaning on the countertops in the kitchen. Now what? I'd never had an episode quite like this, but my wife Louise is no stranger to back troubles, and she offered to loan me the cane she occasionally uses. She might as well have suggested that we start shopping for a nursing home. "You can't be serious," I proclaimed, embarking on a brief and ineffective cane mutiny. At 69, I considered myself far too young and fit for such a symbol of senescence. The riddle of the Sphinx flashed through my mind. What walks on 4 feet in the morning, 2 at noon, and 3 at night? Oedipus knew that if it was us, from crawling baby to upright maturity to old age, when a staff or cane becomes a third foot. I had enough trouble with the feet I've got. not least their tendency to find their way into my mouth. And the cane and offer seemed especially objectionable. Were I to require a cane, I like to think it would be custom made from select hardwoods, polished to a sheen worthy of Fred Astaire, and heavy enough to brain anyone foolish enough to accost me with nefarious intentions. Louise's emergency cane was made of featherweight aluminum by a medical supply company. But it had a crucial feature, adjustability, that made it possible for me to use it even though I'm nearly a foot taller than she is. Before I knew it, she had drawn the stick out to its suitable length. Yes, yes, raising cane, why hold back? And since she had canceled a much anticipated hike due to my infirmary, the least I could do was try it. And you know what? It was a big help. For the uninitiated, what a cane seems to do is take a load off, even though you carry it on only one side. This load shifting enabled me to move around despite my vengeful lower back. I can also report that a cane is more useful than a lot of grunting if you are looking to get out of a chair. One gets the hang of a cane right away, evidently, and in no time, my stance was shifted from aversion to fascination. By midday, my back was significantly better, but I was in no hurry to shed this latest accoutrement of age. Far from an indignity, I thought it meant a certain gravitas, otherwise absent from my banal demeanor. I was soon finding reasons to hobble past the full-length mirror, noting with satisfaction the dignified feature I seemed to cut. I tried leaning on it, hand on hip, and felt myself transformed from a geriatric sourpuss into a bemused observer of the human cavalcade, or so it helped me to imagine. Even as it propped me up, the cane undermined my ability to carry things around. It seemed to strongly prefer my dominant right hand. My left, though free, found it hard to hold a cup of tea steady enough to reach my office without sloshing. How would I fare later, schlepping a precious martini into the living room? I called helpers. It seemed a cane makes demands of its own. Lean it against a table edge, wall, or other angle-free surface, and it's likely to come crashing noisily to the floor, which is not just embarrassing, but requires a lot of bending and groaning unless some helpful onlooker leaps to the rescue. And then there was the sound. I'd assumed my gait would take on a rhythmic thumping, that auditory mark of cane. But with an aluminum version, this was more of an anemic click, possibly easier on fours and eardrums, but certainly less imposing. Yet, thanks to Louise Kane, I was able. I see now that it's easy to be cavalier about the paraphernalia of aging when you know they are only temporary. But of course, everything is only temporary, including the good health. I felt sure would enable me to lay aside the cane when my back was better. Seated at my desk, wondering where I had left the darn thing, another burden of cane using, I began to think of it in more sober terms as a memento mori, or at least a reminder of disability, some form of which may be lurking in my future. Fortunately, I have not had to get too used to it. Soon enough, my back was functioning normally, and the cane went back into the closet, where it reposes in a great show of harmlessness, a harbinger of decline among golf umbrellas, hockey sticks, and other emblems of fleeting good health. Knowing it's there is a mixed blessing. And now, business is booming for brands that sell beverages to aid sleep. Many people don't sleep well, and now there is a booming class of companies that say you can drink your way to better sleep, not booze. Alcohol actually messes up your shut eye. The new breed of nightcaps generally combines minerals, vitamins, and herbs offered in flavors such as hot cocoa, mixed berry, and vanilla latte. Sales are surging for brands such as Somm Sleep and Dream Water, boosted by social media trends, including Sleep Max, optimizing your disease, and the sleepy girl Mocktail. Devices like the Apple Watch, Oura Ring, and Whoop have growing numbers of consumers tracking their sleep and searching for ways to improve it. Jenna Anderson Cohn, 40 years old, is a sleep drink veteran. She has ordered some sleep in bulk, used Natural Vitality's Calm drink mix, and has tried Moon Brew. You sort of just feel like you're able to relax into sleep, said Anderson Cohn, who runs an online fitness community and co-owns a hotel and event space in New Buffalo, Michigan. I just function so much better if I am well rested the next day. About 22% of United States adults said they drink beverages that claim to help them with sleep, according to a 2024 data report from market research firm Mintel. That is up from about 16% in 2023. Sales of sleep supplements, which include powdered drink mixes generally added to milk or water, have totaled about $1 billion in 2025, up 6.4% from the year earlier, according to market research firm Spin. Ready-to-drink liquid sleep drink sales reached 2.71 million, up from 1.8 million. The sleep-deprived are a big potential market. About 37% of American adults get less than the recommended amount of at least 7 hours of sleep a night, according to federal data. Some sleep has seen sales double in 2025 from a year earlier, while sales at Moon Brew have grown more than 150%, the company said. At Deli Bra Health Brand, sales of its Dream Water products were up 34% in the 12 months, which ended this past June 30th. The company's shot-sized drinks come in flavors such as Snoozeberry and are ubiquitous in airport kiosks across North America. Some United States-based Hilton and Choice hotels in Canada have also started carrying them. Moon Brew, which launched its sleep drinks back in 2022, sells powdered mixes for $48 a container or less for monthly subscriptions. Moon Brew co-founder and CEO Alan Shen said that beverages are also meant to be a tasty treat that people look forward to before bed, with the preparation adding a ritual element. Hot cocoa is the most popular of Moon Brew's 7 flavors. The mixes contain magnesium, the amino acid L-theanine, and other ingredients. People are saying, I know I only got 30 minutes of sleep deep and an hour of REM. Help, said Kat Cole, chief executive of AG1. In August, the company behind the popular green powder supplement started selling AGZ, its new product for sleep. AGC contains the herb ashwagandha, along with magnesium, the spice saffron, and more than a dozen other ingredients. The 30-night supply costs $99, or $79 if bought as a recurring subscription. Getting the taste right has been a challenge, said Cole. AGZ comes in chocolate, chocolate mint, and mixed berry flavors. You taste the earth, she said. It's not chocolate milk. Evidence for many of the ingredients in sleep drinks is mixed, said Jennifer L. Martin, a sleep specialist at Florida International University's College of Medicine. Some studies of magnesium, for example, find it beneficial for sleep, while others show no effect. Taking L-theanine does improve people's perception of the quality of their sleep and how long it takes to nod off, according to a review of research published in 2025 in the journal Sleep Medicine Reviews. Ashwagandha is linked to improved sleep, according to a review which was published back in 2021 in the journal ELS1. People believe that these things will help them, and that in and of itself helps people feel more relaxed and able to fall asleep, Martin said. Meditation, reading a book, or sipping herbal tea are a lot less expensive and probably equally effective. Supplements can interact with prescription medication. So Martin advises people to check with their doctor, BTR, before using any of them. And now, as we're in 2026, the 21st century is getting old. Kind of snuck up on us, and we can perhaps be excused for that, because there has been so much going on these past few years. But as New Year's Eve make the turn to 2026, it is probably time for us to say goodbye to the notion of the new century. The 21st century has continued to feel new for many Earthlings, those of us whose lives had one foot in the old century, the 20th, whose early years featured Model Ts and Flappers and the Wright brothers and Teddy Roosevelt, and one foot in the 21st, which arrived like a crisp blank page. No wonder that the century in which we now live is still widely regarded as, at heart, a new one, filled with both promise and trepidation. There was something sort of thrilling in the sense that we were pioneers in a brand new millennium, one so fresh and unsullied. But the dawn of 2026 will mean that the 21st century is now more than one quarter finished. There's nothing new about it. It is well along its way. If we were a professional basketball team, the scoreboard would already be filled with numbers, and we'd realize there are about to be 12 minutes until halftime. The newborns who entered the world in the year 2000 will begin to turn 26. They will have no recollection of the 20th century. Gerald Ford and Frank Sinatra might as well be Martin Van Buren and John Philip Sousa. Steve Jobs and Neil Armstrong could as easily be Alexander Graham Bell and Daniel Boone. 25 years into any new century, quite a bit will have happened. By 1926, things that had been at the century's dawn had never been a part of daily life. Vacuum cleaners, humans taking flight, military tanks, stainless steel, suddenly were. In 2026, things that were never part of the 20th century, YouTube, smartphones, Uber, even artificial intelligence chatbots, will have been around for a while, a ho-hum given. And what lies ahead? By 1926, there has already been a world war, the war to end all wars, and, as in this century, a global pandemic. People could be forgiven for not foreseeing the earth-shattering events that were around the bend, the Depression, World War II, the birth of Elvis Presley. This 21st century of ours has been a lot of things, but we should get used to the idea that being new is no longer one of them. Some year, a man or woman born in this century will be sworn in as president of the United States. The first president born in the 20th century, John F. Kennedy, was not inaugurated until 1961. Will it take until 2061 for that to happen in our time? That seems like a far way off, except it is not. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.